a KGB major asked Petrov.
Certainly not, Petrov answered quickly, defensively. Didn't you know our submarine was sabotaged? We were lucky to escape with our lives.
Sabotaged? How?
The reactor systems. I am the wrong one to ask on this. I am not an engineer, but it was I who detected the leaks. You see, the radiation film badges showed contamination, but the engine room instruments did not. Not only was the reactor tampered with, but all of the radiation sensing instruments were disabled. I saw this myself. Chief Engineer Melikhin had to rebuild several to locate the leaking reactor piping.
Sviatov can tell you this better. He saw it himself.
The KGB officer was scribbling notes.
And what was your submarine doing so close to the American coast?
What do you mean? Don't you know what our orders were?
What were your orders, Comrade Doctor?
The KGB officer stared hard into Petrov's eyes. The doctor explained, concluding,
I saw the orders. They were posted for all to see, as is normal.
Signed by whom?
Admiral Korov. Who else?
Did you not find those orders a little strange? The major asked angrily.
Do you question your orders, Comrade Major?
Petrov summoned up some spine.
I do not.
What happened to your political officer?
In another space, Ivanov was explaining how the Red October had been detected by American and British ships.
But Captain Romingus evaded them brilliantly. We would have made it except for that damned reactor accident.
You must find who did that to us, Comrade Captain. I wish to see him die myself.
The KGB officer was unmoved.
And what was the last thing the captain said to you?
He ordered me to keep control of my men, not to let them speak with Americans any more than necessary, and he said that the Americans would never get their hands on our ship.
Ivanov's eyes filled with tears at the thought of his captain and his ship, both lost. He was a proud and privileged young Soviet man, the son of a party academician.
Comrade, you and your people must find the bastards who did this to us.
It was very clever, Sviatov was recounting a few feet away.
Even Comrade Melikhin only found it on his third attempt, and he swore vengeance on the men who did it.
I saw it myself, the lieutenant said, forgetting that he never had, really.
He explained it in detail, to the point of drawing a diagram of how it had been done.
I don't know about the final accident. I was just coming on duty then. Melikhin, Sertsboy, and Bugayev worked for hours attempting to engage our auxiliary power systems.
He shook his head.
I tried to join them, but Captain Romius forbade it. I tried again, against orders, but Comrade Petrov prevented me.
2 hours over the Atlantic, the senior KGB interrogators met aft to compare notes.
So, if this captain was acting, he was devilishly good at it,
the colonel in charge of the initial interrogation summarized.
His orders to his men were impeccable. The mission orders were announced and posted as is normal.
But who among these men knows Korov's signature?
And we can't very well ask Korov, can we? A major said.
The commander of the Northern Fleet had died of a cerebral hemorrhage 2 hours into his first interrogation in the Lubyanka, much to everyone's disappointment.
It could have been forged in any case. Do we have a secret submarine base in Cuba? And what of the death of the Zampalit?
The doctor is sure it was an accident, another major answered. The captain thought he had struck his head, but he had actually broken his neck. I feel they should have radioed for instructions, though.
A radio silence order, the colonel said. I checked. This is entirely normal for missile submarines.
Was this Captain Romius skilled in unarmed combat? Might he have murdered the Zampalit?
A possibility, mused the major, who had questioned Petrov. He was not trained in such things, but it is not hard to do.
The colonel did not know whether to agree.
Do we have any evidence that the crew thought a defection was being attempted?
All heads shook negatively.
Was the submarine's operational routine otherwise normal?
Yes, Comrade Colonel, a young captain said.
The surviving navigation officer Ivanov says that the evasion of the imperialist surface and sub-forces was effected perfectly, exactly in accordance with established procedures.
but executed brilliantly by this Romeus fellow over a period of 12 hours. I have not even suggested that treason might be involved. Yet.
Everyone knew that these sailors would be spending time in the Lubyanka until each head had been picked clean.
Very well, the colonel said. Up to this point we have no indication of treason by the officers of the submarine.
I thought not.
Comrades, you will continue your interrogations in a gentler fashion until we arrive in Moscow.
Allow your charges to relax.
The atmosphere on the aircraft gradually became more pleasant. Snacks were served, and vodka to loosen the tongues and encourage comradely good fellowship with the KGB officers, who were drinking water. The men all knew that they would be imprisoned for some time, and this fate was accepted with what, to a Westerner, would be surprising fatalism. The KGB would be working for weeks to reconstruct every event on the submarine, from the time the last line was cast off at Poliani to the moment the last man entered the Mystic. Other teams of agents were already working worldwide to learn if what happened to the Red October was a CIA plot or the plot of some other intelligence service. The KGB would find its answer, but the colonel in charge of the case was beginning to think the answer did not lie with these seamen.
The Red October. Noise allowed Romeus to walk the 15 feet from sickbay to the wardroom under supervision. The patient did not look very good, but this was largely because he needed a wash and a shave, like everyone else aboard. Borodin and Mancuso assisted him into his seat at the head of the table.
So, Ryan, how are you today?
Good, thank you, Captain Romeus. Ryan smiled over his coffee. In fact, he was hugely relieved, having, for the past several hours, been able to leave the question of running the sub to the men who actually knew something about it. Though he was counting the hours until he could get out of the Red October, for the first time in 2 weeks, he was neither seasick nor terrified.
How is your leg, sir?
Painful. I must learn not to be shot again. I did not remember saying to you that I owe you my life, as all of us do.
It was my life, too, Ryan replied, a little embarrassed.
Good morning, sir.
It was the cook.
May I fix you some breakfast, Captain Romeus?
Yes, I am very hungry.
Good. One U.S. Navy breakfast. Let me get some fresh coffee, too.
He disappeared into the passageway. 30 seconds later, he was back with fresh coffee and a place setting for Romeus.
10 minutes on the breakfast, sir.
Romeus poured a cup of coffee. There was a small envelope in the saucer.
What is this?
Coffee, mate, Mancuso chuckled.
Cream for your coffee, Captain. Romeus tore open the packet, staring suspiciously inside before dumping the contents into the cup and stirring.
When do we leave?
Sometime tomorrow, Mancuso answered.
The Dallas was going to periscope depth periodically to receive operational orders and relaying them to the October by Gertrude.
We learned a few hours ago that the Soviet fleet is heading back northeast. We'll know for sure by sundown. Our guys are keeping a close eye on them.
Where do we go? Romeus asked.
Where did you tell them you were going?
Ryan wanted to know.
What exactly did your letter say?
You know about the letter? How?
We know, that is, I know about the letter, but that's all I can say, sir.
I told Uncle Yuri that we were sailing to New York to make a present of this ship to the President of the United States.
But you didn't head for New York, Mancuso objected.
Certainly not. I wish to enter Norfolk. Why go to a civilian port when a naval base is so close? You say I should tell Pedorin the truth?
Romeus shook his head.
Why? Your coast is so large.
Dear Admiral Pedorin, I'm sailing for New York.
No wonder they went ape, Ryan thought.
We go to Norfolk or Charleston? Romeus asked.
Norfolk, I think, Mancuso said.
Didn't you know they'd send the whole fleet after you? Ryan snapped. Why send the letter at all?
So they will know, Romeus answered. So they will know. I did not expect that anyone would locate us.
There, you surprised us. The American skipper tried not to smile.
We detected you off the coast of Iceland. You were luckier than you imagine. If we'd sailed from England on schedule, we'd have been 15 miles closer inshore, and we would have had you cold. Sorry, Captain, but our sonars and sonar operators are very good. You can meet the man who first tracked you later. He's working with your man Bugayev at the moment.
Starshina, Borodin said.
Not an officer? Ramius asked.
No, just a very good operator, Mancuso said, surprised.
Why would anyone want an officer to stand watch on sonar gear? The cook came back in. His idea of the standard U.S. Navy breakfast was a large platter with a slab of ham, 2 eggs over easy, a pile of hash browns, and 4 slices of toast, with a container of apple jelly.
Let me know if you want more, sir, the cook said.
This is a normal breakfast? Ramius asked Mancuso.
Nothing unusual about it. I prefer waffles myself. Americans eat big breakfasts.
Ramius was already attacking his. After 2 days without a normal meal and all the blood loss from his leg wound, his body was screaming for food.
Tell me, Ryan, Borodin was lighting a cigarette. What is it in America that we will find most amazing?
Jack motioned to the captain's plate.
Food stores.
Food stores? Mancuso asked.
While I was sitting on Invincible, I read over a CIA report on people who come over to our side. Ryan didn't want to say defectors. Somehow the words sounded demeaning. Supposedly, the first thing that surprises people from your part of the world, is going through a supermarket.
Tell me about them, Borodin ordered.
A building about the size of a football field. Well, maybe a little smaller than that. You go in the front door and get a shopping cart. The fresh fruits and vegetables are on the right, and you gradually work your way left through the other departments. I've been doing that since I was a kid.
You say fresh fruits and vegetables? What about now, in winter?
What about winter? Mancuso said. Maybe they cost a little more, but you can always get fresh produce. That's the one thing we miss on the boats. Our supply of fresh produce and milk only lasts us about a week.
And meat? Ramius asked.
Anything you want, Ryan answered. Beef, pork, lamb, turkey, chicken. American farmers are very efficient. The United States feeds itself and has plenty left over. You know that. The Soviet Union buys our grain. Hell, we pay farmers not to grow things, just to keep the surplus under control.
The 4 Russians were doubtful.
What else? Borodin asked.
What else will surprise you? Nearly everyone has a car. Most people own their own homes. If you have money, you can buy nearly anything you want. The average family in America makes something like $20,000 a year, I guess. These officers all make more than that. The fact of the matter is that in our country, if you have some brains, and all of you men do, and you are willing to work, and all of you men are, you will live a comfortable life even without any help. Besides, you can be sure that the CIA will take good care of you. We wouldn't want anybody to complain about our hospitality.
And what will become of my men? Ramius asked.
I can't say exactly, sir, since I've never been involved in this sort of thing myself. I would guess that you will be taken to a safe place to relax and unwind. People from the CIA and the Navy will want to talk to you at length. That's no surprise, right? I told you this before. A year from now, you will be doing whatever you choose to do.
And anybody who wants to take a cruise with us is welcome to, Mancuso added.
Ryan wondered how true this was. The Navy would not want to let any of these men on a 688-class boat. It might give one of them information valuable enough to enable him to return home and keep his head.
How does a friendly man become a CIA spy? Borodin asked.
I am not a spy, sir, Ryan said again. He couldn't blame them for not believing him. Going through graduate school, I got to know a guy who mentioned my name to a friend of his in the CIA, Admiral James Greer. Back a few years ago, I was asked to join a team of academics that was called in to check up on some of the CIA's intelligence estimates. At the time, I was happily engaged writing books on naval history. At Langley, I was there for 2 months during the summer. I did a paper on international terrorism. Greer liked it, and 2 years ago he asked me to go work there full-time. I accepted. It was a mistake, Ryan said, not really meaning it. Or did he?
A year ago, I was transferred to London to work on a joint intelligence evaluation team with the British Secret Service. My normal job is to sit at a desk and figure out the stuff that field agents send in. I got myself roped into this because I figured out what you were up to, Captain Ramius.
Was your father a spy? Borodin asked.
No, my dad was a police officer in Baltimore. He and my mother were killed in a plane crash 10 years ago.
Borodin expressed his sympathy.
And you, Captain Mancuso, what made you a sailor?
I wanted to be a sailor since I was a kid. My dad's a barber. I decided on submarines at Annapolis because I thought it looked interesting.
Ryan was watching something he had never seen before. Men from two different places and two very different cultures trying to find common ground. Both sides were reaching out, seeking similarities of character and experience, building a foundation for understanding. This was more than interesting. It was touching. Ryan wondered how difficult it was for the Soviets. Probably harder than anything he had ever done. Their bridges were burned. They had cast themselves away from everything they had known, trusting that what they found would be better. Ryan hoped they would succeed and make their transition from communism to freedom. In the past 2 days, he had come to realize what courage it took for men to defect. Facing a gun in a missile room was a small matter compared with walking away from one's whole life. It was strange how easily Americans put on their freedoms. How difficult would it be for these men who had risked their lives to adapt to something that men like Ryan so rarely appreciated? It was people like these who had built the American dream, and people like these who were needed to maintain it. It was odd that such men should come from the Soviet Union. Or perhaps not so odd, Ryan thought, listening to the conversation going back and forth in front of him. The 17th day. Sunday, 19th December. The Red October.
8 more hours, Ryan whispered to himself. That's what they had told him. An 8-hour run to Norfolk. He was back at the rudder diving plane controls by his own request. Operating them was the only thing he knew how to do, and he had to do something. The October was still badly short-handed. Nearly all of the Americans were helping out in the reactor and engine spaces aft. Only Mancuso, Ramius, and himself were in control. Bugayev, with the help of Jones, was monitoring the sonar equipment a few feet away, and the medical people were still worrying over William in the sick bay. The cook was shuttling back and forth with sandwiches and coffee, which Ryan found disappointing, probably because he had been spoiled by Greer's. Ramius was half sitting on the rail that surrounded the periscope pedestal. The leg wound was not bleeding, but it had to be hurting more than the man admitted, since he was letting Mancuso check the instruments and handle the navigation.
"Rudder amidships," Mancuso ordered.
"Midships." Ryan turned the wheel back to the right to center it, checking his rudder angle indicator.
"Rudder is amidships, steady on course, 120.
Mancuso frowned at his chart, nervous at being forced to pilot the massive submarine in so cavalier a manner.
"You have to be careful around here. The sandbar keeps building up from the southerly littoral drift, and they have to dredge it every few months. The storm this area's been having can't have helped much."
Mancuso went back to look through the periscope.
"I am told this is a dangerous area," Ramius said.
"The graveyard of the Atlantic," Mancuso confirmed. "A lot of ships have died along the outer banks. Weather and current conditions are bad enough. The Germans are supposed to have had a hell of a time here during the war. Your charts don't show it, but there's hundreds of wrecks spotted on the bottom."
He went back to the chart table.
"Anyway, we give this place a nice wide berth, and we don't turn north till about here."
He traced a line on the chart.
"These are your waters," Ramius agreed.
They were in a loose three-boat formation. The Dallas was leading them out to sea. The Pogey was trailing. All three boats were traveling flooded down, their decks nearly awash, with no one on their bridge stations. All visual navigation was being done by periscope. No radar sets were operating. None of the three boats was making any electronic noise. Ryan glanced casually at the chart table. They were beyond the inlet proper, but the chart was marked with sandbars for several more miles.
nor were they using the Red October's Caterpillar drive system. It had turned out to be almost exactly what Skip Tyler had predicted. There were two sets of tunnel impellers, a pair about a third of the way back from the bow, and three more just aft of midships. Mancuso and his engineers had examined the plans with great interest, then commented at length on the quality of the Caterpillar design. For his part, Ramius had not wanted to believe that he had been detected so early on. Mancuso had ultimately produced Jones with his personal map to show the October's estimated course off Iceland. Though a few miles off the ship's log, it was too close to have been a coincidence.
"Your sonar must be better than we expected," Ramius grumbled a few feet from Ryan's control station.
"It is pretty good," Mancuso allowed. "Better yet, there's Jonesy. He's the best sonar man I've ever had."
"So young and so smart."
"We get a lot of them that way," Mancuso smiled. "Never as many as we'd like, of course, but our kids are all volunteers. They know what they're getting into. We're picky about who we take, and then we train the hell out of them."
"Con sonar!"
It was Jones's voice.
"Dallas is diving, sir."
"Very well." Mancuso lit a cigarette as he went to the intercom phone. He punched the button for engineering.
"Tell Mannion we need him forward. We'll be diving in a few minutes."
"Yeah." He hung up and went back to the chart.
"You have them for more than 3 years, then?" Ramius asked.
"Oh, yeah. Hell, otherwise, we'd be letting them go right after they're fully trained, right?"
Why couldn't the Soviet Navy get and retain people like this? Ramius thought. He knew the answer all too well. The Americans fed their men decently, gave them a proper mess room, paid them decently, gave them trust. All the things he had fought 20 years for.
"You need me to work on the vents?" Mannion said, coming in.
"Yeah, Pat. We'll dive in another 2 or 3 minutes."
Mannion gave the chart a quick look on his way to the vent manifold. Ramius hobbled to the chart.
"They tell us that your officers are chosen from the bourgeois classes to control ordinary sailors from the working class."
Mannion ran his hands over the vent controls. There sure were enough of them. He spent 2 hours the previous day figuring the complex system out.
"That's true, sir. Our officers do come from the ruling class. Just look at me," he said deadpan.
Mannion's skin was about the color of coffee grounds, his accent pure South Bronx.
"But you are a black man," Ramius objected, missing the jibe.
"Sure, we're a real ethnic boat."
Mancuso looked through the periscope again.
"A guinea skipper, a black navigator, and a crazy sonar man."
"I heard that, sir,"
Jones called out, rather than use the intercom speaker.
"Gertrude message from Dallas. Everything looks okay. They're waiting for us. Last Gertrude message for a while."
"Can't I?" "We're clear, finally. We can dive whenever you wish, Captain Ramius," Mancuso said.
"Comrade Mannion, vent the ballast tanks," Ramius said.
The October had never actually surfaced and was still rigged for dive.
"Aye, aye, sir."
The lieutenant turned the topmost rank of master switches on the hydraulic controls. Ryan winced. The sound made him think of a million toilets being flushed at once.
5 degrees down on the planes, Ryan," Ramius said.
5 degrees down, aye."
Ryan pushed forward on the yoke. "Planes, 5 degrees down."
"She's slow going down,"
Mannion observed, watching the hand-painted depth gauge replacement.
"So darn big."
"Yeah,"
Mancuso said. The needle passed 20 meters.
"Planes to zero," Ramius said.
"Planes to zero angle, aye."
Ryan pulled back on the control. It took 30 seconds for the submarine to settle. She seemed very slow to respond to the controls. Ryan had thought that submarines were as responsive as aircraft.
"Make her a little light, Pat. Enough that it takes a degree of down to hold her level," Mancuso said.
"Uh-huh,"
Mannion frowned, checking the depth gauge. The ballast tanks were now fully flooded, and the balancing act would have to be done with the much smaller trim tank. It took him 5 minutes to get the balance exactly right.
"Sorry, gentlemen, I'm afraid she's too big to dial in quick," he said, embarrassed with himself.
Ramius was impressed, but too annoyed to show it. He had expected the American captain to take longer than this to do it himself, trimming a strange sub so expertly on his first try.
"Okay, now we can come around north," Mancuso said.
They were 2 miles past the last charted bar.
Recommend new course 008, Captain.
Ryan, rudder left 10 degrees, Ramius ordered. Come to 008.
Okay, rudder left 10 degrees, Ryan responded, keeping an eye on the rudder indicator, the other on the gyro compass repeater. Come to 008.
Caution, Ryan. He turned slowly, but once turning, you must use much backward.
Opposite, Mancuso corrected politely.
Yes, opposite rudder to stop him on proper course.
Right.
Captain, do you have rudder problems? Mancuso asked. From tracking you, it seemed that your turning circle was rather large.
With the caterpillar it is. The flow from the tunnels strikes the rudder very hard, and it flutters if you use too much rudder. On our first sea trials, we had damage from this. It comes from, how do you say, the come-together of the two caterpillar tunnels.
Does this affect operations with the propellers? Mannion asked.
No, only with the caterpillar.
Mancuso didn't like that.
It didn't really matter. The plan was a simple, direct one. The three boats would make a straight dash to Norfolk. The two American attack boats would leapfrog forwards at 30 knots to sniff out the area ahead, while the October plodded along at a constant 20.
Ryan began to ease his rudder as the bow came around. He waited too long. Despite 5 degrees of right rudder, the bow swung right past the intended course, and the gyro repeater clicked accusingly on every third degree until it stopped at 001. It took another 2 minutes to get back on the proper course.
Sorry about that. Steady on 008, he finally reported.
Ramius was forgiving.
You learned fast, Ryan. Perhaps one day you will be a true sailor.
No thanks. The one thing I've learned on this ship is that you guys earn every nickel you get.
Don't like subs? Mannion chuckled.
No place to jog.
True. Unless you still need me, Captain, I'm ready to go aft. The engine room's awful short-handed, Mannion said.
Ramius nodded. Was he from the ruling class? The captain wondered.
The V.K. Konovalov. Tupolev was heading back west. The fleet order had instructed everyone but his Alpha and one other to return home at 20 knots. Tupolev was to move west for 2.5 hours. Now he was on a reciprocal heading at 5 knots, about the top speed the Alpha could travel without making much noise. The idea was that his sub would be lost in the shuffle. So, an Ohio was heading for Norfolk, or Charleston more probably. In any case, Tupolev would circle quietly and observe. The Red October was destroyed. That much he knew from the ops order. Tupolev shook his head. How could Marco have done such a thing? Whatever the answer, he had paid for his treason with his life.
The Pentagon. I'd feel better if we had some more air cover, Admiral Foster said, leaning against the wall.
Agreed, sir, but we can't be so obvious, can we? General Harris asked.
A pair of P-3Bs was now sweeping the track from Hatteras to the Virginia Capes as though on a routine training mission. Most of the other Orions were far out at sea. The Soviet fleet was already 400 miles offshore. The three surface groups had rejoined and were now ringed by their submarines. The Kennedy, America, and Nimitz were 500 miles to their east, and the New Jersey was dropping back. The Russians would be watched all the way home. The carrier battle groups would be following them all the way to Iceland, keeping a discreet distance and maintaining air groups at the fringe of their radar coverage continuously, just to let them know that the United States still cared. Aircraft base on Iceland would track them the rest of the way home. HMS Invincible was now out of the operation and about halfway home. American attack subs were returning to normal patrol patterns, and all Soviet subs were reported to be off the coast, though this data was sketchy. They were traveling in loose packs, and the noise generated made tracking difficult for the patrolling Orions, which were short of sonar buoys. Still and all, the operation was about over, the J-3 judged.
"You heading for Norfolk, Admiral?" Harris asked.
"Thought I might get together with Sinkland. A post-action conference, you understand," Foster said.
"Aye, aye, sir," Harris said.
the New Jersey. She was traveling at 12 knots, with a destroyer feeling on either beam. Commodore Eaton was in the flag plot. It was all over, and nothing had happened, thank God. The Soviets were now 100 miles ahead, within Tomahawk range, but well beyond everything else. All in all, he was satisfied. His force had operated successfully with the Tarawa, which was now headed south to Mayport, Florida. He hoped they'd be able to do this again soon. It had been a long time since a flag officer on a battleship had had a carrier respond to his command. They had kept the Kirov force under continuous surveillance. If there had been a battle, Eaton was convinced that they'd have handled Ivan. More importantly, he was certain that Ivan knew it. All they awaited now was the order to return to Norfolk. It would be nice to be back home for Christmas. He figured his men had earned it. Many of the battleship's men were old-timers, and nearly everyone had a family. The Red October. Ping! Jones noted the time on his pad and called out, "Captain, just got a ping from Pogie." The Pogie was now 10 miles ahead of the October and Dallas. The idea was that after she got ahead and listened for 10 minutes, a single ping from her active sonar would signal that the 10 miles to the Pogie and the 20 or more miles beyond her were clear. The Pogie would drift slowly to confirm this, and a mile to the October's east, the Dallas went to full speed to leapfrog 10 miles beyond the other attack sub. Jones was experimenting with the Russian sonar. The active gear, he'd found, was not too bad. The passive systems, he didn't want to think about. When the Red October had been lying still in Pamlico Sound, he'd been unable to track in on the American subs. They had also been still, with their reactors only turning generators, but they had been no more than a mile away. He was disappointed that he'd not been able to locate them. The officer with him, Bugayev, was a friendly enough guy. At first he'd been a little standoffish, as if he were a lord and I were a serf, Jones thought, until he'd seen how the skipper treated him. This surprised Jones. From what little he knew of communism, he had expected everyone to be fairly equal. Well, he decided, that's what I get from reading Das Kapital in a freshman poli-sci course. It made a lot more sense to look at what communism built. Garbage, mostly. The enlisted men didn't even have their own mess room. Wasn't that some crap? Eating your meals in your bunk rooms. Jones had taken an hour, when he was supposed to be sleeping, to explore the submarine. Mr. Mannion had joined him. They started in the bunk room. The individual footlockers didn't lock, probably so that officers could rifle through them. Jones and Mannion did just that. There was nothing of interest. Even the sailor porn was junk. The poses were just plain dumb, and the women, well, Jones had grown up in California. Garbage. It was not at all hard for him to understand why the Russians wanted to defect. The missile had been interesting. He and Mannion opened an inspection hatch to examine the inside of the missile. Not too shabby, they thought. There was a little too much loose wiring, but that probably made testing easier. The missile seemed awfully big. So, he thought, that's what the bastards have been aiming at us. He wondered if the Navy would hold on to a few. If it was ever necessary to flip some at old Ivan, might as well include a couple of his own. Dumb idea, Jonesy, he said to himself. He didn't even want those goddamn things to fly. One thing was for sure. Everything on this bucket would be stripped off, tested, taken apart, tested again. And he was the Navy's number one expert on Russian sonar. Maybe he'd be present during the analysis. It might be worth staying in the Navy a few extra months for. Jones lit a cigarette. Want one of mine, Mr. Bugayev? He held his pack out to the electronics officer.
Thank you, Jones. You are in university.
The lieutenant took the American cigarette that he'd wanted but been too proud to ask for. It was dawning on him slowly that this enlisted man was his technical equal. Though not a qualified watch officer, Jones could operate and maintain sonar gear as well as anyone he'd known.
Yes, sir.
It never hurt to call officers sir, Jones knew, especially the dumb ones.
California Institute of Technology. 5 semesters completed. A average.
I didn't finish.
Why did you leave?
Jones smiled.
Well, sir, you gotta understand that Caltech is, well, Kind of a funny place. I played a little trick on one of my professors. He was working with strobe lights for high-speed photography, and I rigged a little switch to work the room lights off the strobe. Unfortunately, there was a short in the switch, and it started this little electrical fire,
which had burned out a lab, destroying 3 months of data and $15,000 of equipment.
That broke the rules.
What did you study?
I was heading for a degree in electrical engineering with a strong minor in cybernetics. 3 semesters to go. I'll get it. Then my master's, then my doctorate. Then I'll go back to work for the Navy as a civilian.
Why are you a sonar operator?
Bugayev sat down. He had never spoken like this with an enlisted man.
Hell, sir, it's fun. When something's going on, you know, a war game, tracking another sub, like that, I am the skipper. All the captain does is react to the data I give him.
And you like your commander?
Sure thing. He's the best I've ever had. I've had 3. My skipper's a good guy. You do your job okay, and he doesn't hassle you. You got something to say to him, and he listens.
You say you will go back to college. How do you pay for it? They tell us that only the ruling class sons go to university.
That's crap, sir. In California, if you're smart enough to go, you go. In my case, I've been saving my money. You don't spend much on a sub, right? And the Navy pitches in, too. I got enough to see me all the way through my master's.
What's your degree in?
I attended a higher naval school, like your Annapolis. I would like to get a proper degree in electronics,
Bugayev said, voicing his own dream.
No sweat. I can help you out. If you're good enough for Caltech, I can tell you who to talk to. You'd like California. That is the place to live.
And they wish to work on a real computer,
Bugayev went on, wistful.
Jones laughed quietly.
So, buy yourself one.
Buy a computer?
Sure. We got a couple of little ones. Apples on Dallas cost you about, $2,000 for a nice system. That's a lot less than what a car goes for.
A computer for $2,000?
Bugayev went from wistful to suspicious, certain that Jones was leading him on.
Or less. For $3,000, you can get a really nice rig. Hell, you tell Apple who you are, and they'll probably give it to you for free, or the Navy will. If you don't want an Apple, there's the Commodore, TRS-80, Atari, all kinds. Depends on what you want to use it for. Look, just one company, Apple, has sold over 1 million of them. They're little, sure, but they're real computers.
I have never heard of this. Apple.
Yeah, Apple. 2 guys started the company back when I was in junior high. Since then, they've sold 1 million or so. Like I said, and they are some kind of rich. I don't have one myself, no room on a sub, but my brother has his own computer, an IBM PC.
You still don't believe me, do you? A working man with his own computer. It is hard to believe.
He stabbed out the cigarette. American tobacco was a little bland, he thought. Well, sir, then you can ask somebody else. Like I said, Dallas has a couple of Apples, just for the crew to use. There's other stuff for fire control, navigation, and sonar, of course. We use the Apples for games. You'll love computer games, for sure.
You've never had fun till you've tried Choplifter, and other things, education programs, stuff like that.
Honest, Mr. Bugayev, you can walk into most any shopping center and find a place to buy a computer. You'll see.
How do you use a computer with your sonar?
Well, that would take a while to explain, sir, and I'd probably have to get permission from the skipper. Jones reminded himself that this guy was still the enemy. Sort of.
The VK Konovalov. The Alpha drifted slowly at the edge of the continental shelf, about 50 miles southeast of Norfolk. Tupolev ordered the reactor plant chopped back to about 5% of total output, enough to operate the electrical systems and little else. It also made his submarine almost totally quiet. Orders were passed by word of mouth. The Konovalov was on a strict silent ship routine. Even ordinary cooking was forbidden. Cooking meant moving metal pots and metal grates. Until further notice, the crew was on a diet of cheese sandwiches. They spoke in whispers, when they spoke at all. Anyone who made noise would attract the attention of the captain, and everyone aboard knew what that meant.
Sosus Control.
Quentin was reviewing data sent by Digital Link from the two Orions. A crippled missile boat, the USS Georgia, was heading into Norfolk after a partial turbine failure, escorted by a pair of attack boats. They had been keeping her out, the Admiral said, because of all the Russian activity on the coast, and the idea now was to get her in, fixed, and out as quickly as possible. The Georgia carried 24 Trident missiles, a noteworthy fraction of the country's total deterrent force. Repairing her would be a high-priority item now that the Russians were gone. It was safe to bring her in, but they wanted the Orions first to check and see if any Soviet submarines had lingered behind in the general confusion. A P-3B was cruising at 900 feet, about 50 miles southeast of Norfolk. The FLIR showed nothing, no heat signature on the surface, and the MAD gear detected no measurable disturbance in the Earth's magnetic field. The one aircraft's flight path took her within 100 yards of the Alpha's position. The Konovalov's hull was made of non-magnetic titanium. A sonobuoy dropped 7 miles to the south of her position also failed to pick up the sound of her reactor plant. Data was being transmitted continuously to Norfolk, where Quentin's operations staff entered it into his computer. The problem was, not all of the Soviet subs had been accounted for. Well, the commander thought, that figures. Some of the boats had taken the opportunity to creep away from their charted loci. There was the odd chance, he had reported, that one or two strays were still out there, but there was no evidence of this. He wondered what Sinkland had working. Certainly, he had seemed awfully pleased with something, almost euphoric. The operation against the Soviet fleet had been handled pretty well. What he'd seen of it, and there was that dead Alpha out there, how long until the Glomar Explorer came out of the mothballs to go and get that? He wondered if he'd get a chance to look the wreck over. What an opportunity. Nobody was taking the current operation all that seriously. It made sense. If the Georgia were indeed coming in with a sick engine, she'd be coming slow, and a slow Ohio made about as much noise as a virgin whale determined to retain her status. And if Sinkland FLT were all that concerned about it, he would not have detailed the delousing operation to a pair of P-3s piloted by reservists. Quentin lifted the phone and dialed Sinkland FLT operations to tell them again that there was no indication of hostile activity. The Red October. Ryan checked his watch. It had been 5 hours already. A long time to sit in one chair, and from a quick glance at the chart, it appeared that the 8-hour estimate had been optimistic, or he'd misunderstood them. The Red October was tracing up the shelf time and would soon begin to angle west for the Virginia Capes. Maybe it would take another 4 hours. It couldn't be too soon. Romius and Mancuso looked pretty tired. Everybody was tired. Probably the engine room people most of all. No, the cook. He was ferrying coffee and sandwiches to everyone. The Russians seemed especially hungry. The Dallas / the Pogey. The Dallas passed the Pogey at 32 knots, leapfrogging again, with the October a few miles aft. Lieutenant Commander Wally Chambers, who had the con, did not like being blind on the speed run of 35 minutes, despite word from the Pogey that everything was clear. The Pogey noted her passage and turned her to allow her lateral array to track on the Red October. "Noisy enough at 20 knots," the Pogey's sonar chief said to his companions. "Dallas doesn't make that much at 30. The VK Konovalov. "Some noise to the south," the Mishman said. "What exactly?" Tupolev had been hovering at the door for hours, making life unpleasant for the sonar man.
"Too soon to say, Comrade Captain. Bearing is not changing. However, it is heading this way."
Tupolev went back to the control room. He ordered power reduced further in the reactor systems. He considered killing the plant entirely, but reactors took time to start up, and there was no telling yet how distant the contact might be. The captain smoked 3 cigarettes before going back to sonar. It would not do at all to make the Mishman nervous. The man was his best operator.
"One propeller, Comrade Captain, an American, probably a Los Angeles, doing 35 knots.
Bearing has changed only 2 degrees in 15 minutes. He will pass close aboard and... Wait. His engines have stopped.
The 40-year-old warrant officer pressed the headphones against his ears. He could hear the cavitation sounds diminish, then stop entirely as the contact faded away to nothing.
He has stopped to listen, Comrade Captain.
Tupolev smiled. He will not hear us, Comrade. Racing and stopping. Can you hear anything else? Might he be escorting something?
The Mishman listened to the headphones again and made some adjustments on his panel.
Perhaps. There is a good deal of surface noise, Comrade, and I... Wait. There seems to be some noise. Our last target bearing was 171, and this new noise is... 175. Very faint, Comrade Captain. A ping. A single ping on active sonar.
So. Tupolev leaned against the bulkhead. Good work, Comrade. Now we must be patient.
The Dallas. Chief Laval pronounced the area clear. The BQQ-5's sensitive receptors revealed nothing, even after the SAP system had been used. Chambers maneuvered the bow around so that the single ping would go out to the Pogi, which in turn fired off her own ping to the Red October to make sure the signal was received. It was clear for another 10 miles. The Pogi moved out at 30 knots, followed by the U.S. Navy's newest boomer.
The VK Konovalov.
Two more submarines, one single screw. The other twin screw, I think. Still faint. The single-screw submarine is turning much more rapidly. Do the Americans have twin-screw submarines, Comrade Captain?
Yes, I believe so. Tupolev wondered about this.
The difference in signature characteristics was not all that pronounced. They'd see in any case. The Konovalov was creeping along at 2 knots, 150 meters beneath the surface. Whatever was coming seemed to be coming right for them. Well, he'd teach the Imperialists something after all.
The Red October.
Can somebody spell me at the wheel? Ryan asked.
Need a stretch? Mancuso asked. Coming over.
Yeah, I could stand a trip to the head, too. The coffee's about to bust my kidneys.
I'll relieve you, sir. The American captain moved into Ryan's seat. Jack headed aft to the nearest head. 2 minutes later, he was feeling much better. Back in the control room, he did some knee bends to get circulation back in his legs, then looked briefly at the chart. It seemed strange, almost sinister, to see the U.S. coast marked in Russian.
Thank you, Commander.
Sure. Mancuso stood.
It is certain that you are no sailor, Ryan.
Ramius had been watching him without a word.
I had never claimed to be one, Captain, Ryan said agreeably.
How long to Norfolk?
Oh, another 4 hours, tops, Mancuso said. The idea is to arrive after dark. They have something to get us in unseen, but I don't know what.
We left the sound in daylight. What if somebody saw us then? Ryan asked.
I didn't see anything. But if anybody was there, all he'd have seen was 3 sub-conning towers with no numbers on them.
They had left in daylight to take advantage of a window in the Soviet satellite coverage.
Ryan lit another cigarette. His wife would give him hell for this, but he was tense from being on the submarine. Sitting at the helmsman station left him with nothing to do but stare at the handful of instruments. The sub was easier to hold level than he had expected, and the only radical turn he had attempted showed how eager the sub was to change course in any direction. 30-some-thousand tons of steel, he thought. No wonder.
The Pogi / the Red October. The Pogi stormed past the Dallas at 30 knots and continued for 20 minutes, stopping 11 miles beyond her and 3 miles from the Konovalov, whose crew was scarcely breathing now. The Pogi's sonar, though lacking the new BC-10 SAPS signal processing system, was otherwise state-of-the-art, but it was impossible to hear something that made no noise at all, and the Konovalov was silent. The Red October passed the Dallas at 1500 hours after receiving the latest all-clear signal. Her crew was tired and looking forward to arriving at Norfolk 2 hours after sundown.
Ryan wondered how quickly he could fly back to London. He was afraid that the CIA would want to debrief him at length. Mancuso and the crewmen of the Dallas wondered if they'd get to see their families. They weren't counting on it.
The VK Konovalov.
Whatever it is big, very big, I think. His course will take him within 5 kilometers of us.
In Ohio, as Moscow said, Tupolev commented.
It sounds like a twin-screw submarine, Comrade Captain, the Mishman said.
The Ohio has one propeller, you know that.
Yes, Comrade, in any case, he will be with us in 20 minutes. The other attack submarine is moving at 30+ knots. If the pattern holds, he will proceed 15 kilometers beyond us.
And the other American?
A few kilometers seaward, drifting slowly like us. I do not have an exact range. I could raise him on active sonar, but that...
I am aware of the consequences, Tupolev snapped. He went back to the control room. Tell the engineers to be ready to answer bells. All men at battle stations.
Yes, Comrade Captain, the Starpom replied. We have an excellent firing solution on the American Hunter sub, the one moving, that is. The way he runs at full speed makes it easy for us. The other we can localize in seconds.
Good. For a change. Tupolev smiled. You see what we can do when circumstances favor us.
And what shall we do?
When the big one passes us, we will close and ream his asshole. They have played their games. Now we shall play ours. Have the engineers increase power. We will need full power shortly.
It will make noise, comrade,
the Starpom cautioned. True, but we have no choice. 10% power. The Ohio cannot possibly hear that, and perhaps the Near Hunter sub won't either.
The Pogi. Where did that come from? The sonar chief made some adjustments on his board.
Con sonar, I got a contact bearing 230.
Con I, Commander Wood answered at once. Can you classify?
No, sir, it just came up. Reactor plant and steam noises. Real faint, sir. I can't quite read the plant signature.
He flipped the gain controls to maximum.
Not one of ours. Skipper, I think maybe we got us an alpha here.
Oh, great. Signal Dallas right now.
The chief tried, but the Dallas, running at 32 knots, missed the 5 rapid pings. The Red October was now 8 miles away.
The Red October. Jones's eyes suddenly screwed shut.
Mr. Bugayev, tell the skipper I just heard a couple of pings.
Couple?
More'n one, but I didn't get a count.
The Pogi. Commander Wood made his decision. The idea had been to send the sonar signals on a highly directional, low-power basis so as to minimize the chance of revealing his own position. But the Dallas hadn't picked that up.
Max power, Chief. Hit Dallas with everything.
Aye, aye. The Chief flipped his power controls to full. It took several seconds until the system was ready to send 100 kilowatt blast of energy.
Ping, 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 ping.
The Dallas.
Wow! Chief Lavell exclaimed. Con, sonar, danger signal from Pogi.
All stop, Chambers ordered. Quiet ship.
All stop,
Lieutenant Goodman relayed the orders a second later. Aft, the reactor watch reduced steam demand, increasing the temperature in the reactor. This allowed neutrons to escape out of the pile, rapidly slowing the fission reaction.
When speed gets to 4 knots, go to 1/3 speed, Chambers told the officer of the deck as he went aft to the sonar room.
Frenchie, I need data in a hurry.
Still going too fast, sir, Laval said.
The Red October.
Captain Ramius, I think we should slow down, Mancuso said judiciously.
The signal was not repeated.
Ramius disagreed. The second directional signal had missed them, and the Dallas had not relayed the danger signal yet because she was still traveling too fast to locate the October and pass it along.
The Pogi.
Okay, sir, Dallas has killed power.
Wood chewed on his lower lip.
All right, let's find the bastard.
Yankee search, Chief, max power.
He went back to control.
Man battle stations.
An alarm went off 2 seconds later. The Pogi had already been at increased readiness, and within 40 seconds all stations were manned, with the executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Tom Reynolds,
as fire control coordinator. His team of officers and technicians were waiting for data to feed into the Mark 117 fire control computer. The sonar dome in the Pogi's bow was blasting sound energy into the water. 15 seconds after it started, the first return signal appeared on Chief Palmer's screen.
Con sonar, we have a positive contact bearing 234, range 6,000 yards. Classify probable alpha class from his plant signature, Palmer said.
Give me a solution, Wood said urgently.
Aye.
Reynolds watched the data input as another team of officers was making a paper and pencil plot on the chart table. Computer or not, there had to be a backup. The data paraded across the screen. The Pogi's four torpedo tubes contained a pair of Harpoon anti-ship missiles and two Mark 48 torpedoes. Only the torpedoes were useful at the moment. The Mark 48 was the most powerful torpedo in the inventory. Wire-guided and able to hone in with its own active sonar. It ran at over 50 knots and carried a half-ton warhead.
Skipper, we got a solution for both fish. Running time, 4 minutes, 35 seconds.
Sonar, secure pinging, Wood said.
Aye, aye, pinging secured, sir.
Palmer killed power to the active systems.
Target elevation depression angle is near zero, sir. He's about at our depth.
Very well, sonar, keep on him. Wood now had his target's position. Further pinging would only give it a better idea of his own. The Dallas.
Pogi was pinging something. They got a return, bearing 191 about, Chief Laval said. There's another sub out there, I don't know what. I can read some plant and steam noises, but not enough for a signature.
The Pogi.
The boomer's still moving, sir, Chief Palmer reported.
Skipper, Reynolds looked up from the paper tracks. Her course takes her between us and the target.
Terrific. All ahead 1/3. Left 20 degrees rudder.
Wood moved to the sonar room while his orders were carried out.
Chief, power up and stand by to ping the boomer hard.
Aye, aye, sir. Palmer worked his controls.
Ready, sir.
Hit him straight on. I don't want him to miss this time. Wood watched the heading indicator on the sonar plot swing. The Pogi was turning rapidly, but not rapidly enough to suit him. The Red October, only he and Reynolds knew that she was Russian, though the crew was speculating like mad, was coming in too fast.
Ready, sir.
Hit it. Palmer punched the impulse control.
Ping, 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 ping.
The Red October.
Skipper, Jones yelled. Danger signal.
Mancuso jumped to the annunciator without waiting for Ramius to react. He twisted the dial to all stop. When this was done, he looked at Ramius.
Sorry, sir.
All right. Ramius scowled at the chart. The phone buzzed a moment later. He took it and spoke in Russian for several seconds before hanging up.
I told them that we have a problem, but we do not know what it is.
True enough, Mancuso joined Ramius at the chart. Engine noises were diminishing, though not quickly enough to suit the American. The October was quiet for a Russian sub, but this was still too noisy for him.
See if your sonar men can locate anything, Ramius suggested.
Right. Mancuso took a few steps aft.
Jonesy, find what's out there.
Aye, Skipper, but it won't be easy on this gear.
He already had the sensor arrays working in the direction of the two escorting attack zones. Jones adjusted the fit of his headphones and started working on the amplifier controls. No signal processors, no saps, and the transducers weren't worth a damn. But this wasn't the time to get excited. The Soviet systems had to be manipulated electromechanically, unlike the computer-controlled ones he was used to. Slowly and carefully, he altered the directional receptor gangs in the sonar dome forward, his right hand twirling a cigarette pack, his eyes shut tight. He didn't notice Bugayev sitting next to him, listening to the same input. The Dallas.
What do we know, Chief? Chambers asked.
I got a bearing and nothing else. Pogi's got him all dialed in, but our friend powered back his engine right after he got lashed, and he faded out on me. Pogi got a big return off him. He's probably pretty close, sir.
Chambers had only moved up to his executive officer's posting 4 months earlier. He was a bright, experienced officer and a likely candidate for his own command, but he was only 33 years old and had only been back in submarines for those 4 months. The year and a half prior to that, he'd been a reactor instructor in Idaho. The gruffness that was part of his job as Mancuso's principal on board.